The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, and thanks for having me. I got interested in the subject of why the economy was generating far-right backlash about 11 years ago when I started work on this book, and I put it aside three times to write three other books after Obama was elected president, after we had a financial collapse. And then in the past year or so, when the situation got really urgent, I finished the book. And here's the argument in a nutshell. We had a remarkable period after World War II, and I see this audience, most of you are my generation. We grew up thinking of the post-war economy as normal, but it really was kind of an anomaly. What was the post-war economy? The post-war economy was a very good balance between the market part of the system and the more social part of the system. If you look at the 30 years after World War II, the economy not only grew at an unprecedented rate of about 4% a year for 30 years, but it also became more equal, a feat that has never been duplicated before or since. And the basic argument of the book is that when that social contract started coming unglued, beginning in the 1970s and more emphatically in the 1980s and the 1990s, regular people started feeling that the economy and the political system was not serving their interests. And that happened not just in the United States, but it happened in Europe. And then after the collapse of 2008, when things became really toxic and centrist political parties were not providing persuasive alternatives, people started turning to the far right. It's not a coincidence that this is happening all over the West. It's a systemic problem. And when you add to that brew the claims of immigrants and refugees and other groups asking for acceptance into the society, at a time when ordinary working class people feel that elites don't care about them, you really have a combustible mixture. And into this vacuum steps not just Donald Trump, but the sponsors of Brexit in the United Kingdom, and Orban in Hungary, and Erdogan in Turkey, and Kaczynski in Poland, and really neo-fascist parties that are the second or third largest party all over Western Europe. And this replicates the tragedy that happened in the 1920s. So before going on to our own era, let me take you back to the period after World War I. Because the period after World War I was diametrically opposite from what happened after World War II. And in many ways, the sponsors of the post-war economic system after World War II believed that they were learning from the mistakes of what had happened a generation earlier after World War I, mistakes that they were determined never to repeat. So let me take you to Versailles, 1919, almost exactly 100 years ago. France and Germany, with the help of the United States, have defeated Germany. And they've decided that they're really going to teach the Germans a lesson so that Germany can never make war again, and they're going to extract punitive reparations. Germany is going to pay for the cost of the war. The only problem is that the German economy is flat on its back, and the German economy can't possibly pay for the costs of the war. And 3 years later, Germany, to get out of the mess that the Allies put it into by not having any kind of a reconstruction program, resorts to hyperinflation, which then destroys the German middle class and puts us on the road to Hitler And meanwhile, the Allies are not just punishing Germany, they're punishing their own people with austerity programs and efforts to try and prop up the value of the pound to what it had been before 1914, which requires high interest rates. And this was also a period when speculative financial capitalism is allowed to do whatever it wants. So you oscillate between periods of austerity and periods of unbridled speculation, and it all comes crashing down, good side effects, in 1929. Now, economic grievance, when ordinary people are suffering unemployment rates upwards of 20%, and they're losing their livelihoods, economic grievance can go left or it can go right. And in January of 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt was assembling his cabinet, Hitler was preparing to take office as chancellor in Berlin. And we dodged a bullet. We dodged several bullets. We got very lucky that economic grievance in the United States, of which there was plenty, went in the direction of Roosevelt rather than a homegrown Hitler. And we dodged a bullet in a very literal sense. I mean, if you think that anything like the New Deal was inevitable, some of you may recall what happened in February of 1933 when the president-elect was delivering a political speech in Miami, and an anarchist by the name of Joe Zangara got within a few feet of the president and fired five shots point blank and missed and hit the mayor of Chicago instead. And if Zangara had hit Roosevelt, the president would have been, anybody remember? Cactus Jack Garner, a complete nonentity, segregationist from the state of Texas. And in those years, you had to get two-thirds of the delegates to get the presidential nomination. So Roosevelt did not put Garner on the ticket just for ticket balancing purposes because he wanted a Texan the way John Kennedy wanted Lyndon Johnson. Garner was a candidate for president, and he needed to make a deal with Garner to get the nomination. But if Cactus Jack Garner had been elected president, we wouldn't have had the New Deal. So the combination of the New Deal, which tightly regulated financial excess and empowered organized labor and demonstrated that government could do great things, coupled with World War II, when government played an even more major role in the economy and labor unions were recognized as social partners, created the preconditions for a tightly regulated form of capitalism, not socialism. This was still preeminently a capitalist economy, but it was a balanced capitalist economy where ordinary working people could feel that they were getting a fair shake. And then, after the war, at the Bretton Woods Conference of 1944, the founders of the post-war global economic system came up with a set of ground rules that would make it possible for individual nation states to have regulated forms of capitalism. The architect of Bretton Woods was John Maynard Keynes. He wanted Keynesianism to be the principle for the global economy as well as for domestic economies. First and foremost, full employment at good wages. The details of Bretton Woods were not exactly what Keynes had in mind, but it created a system that achieved a good balance between trade resuming, but speculative finance being put back in its box, so that the kind of collapse that happened in 1929 and happened again in 2008 would not destroy the economy. And not coincidentally, there were no neo-fascists that had any kind of political support in the 50s and in the 60s because ordinary people felt they were getting a fair shake. And even in the 60s, when African Americans started demanding their rights, because the economy was performing well for white people, you didn't have the kind of backlash that you might have expected until the economy went south, in both senses of the word. So what happens beginning in the 70s and 80s and 90s, triggered by some random bad things that happened in the 70s, the Bretton Woods system falling apart, the dollar no longer being able to pay the role of anchor currency for the whole global system, the OPEC price increases, we have a bad decade. We have a decade that combines inflation with unemployment, something that's not supposed to exist in economic textbooks. And laissez-faire economics, free market, ultra-free market economics, which had supposedly been discredited for all time by the crash of 1929, it gets another turn at bat. It gets another chance. Theorists like Milton Friedman, who had been dismissed as fringe figures, get another turn to be recognized as prominent economists. History had proven that an ultra-free market economy that lets speculation run wild is not efficient. It's not only not equitable, it's not efficient. And the system that was brought in by Roosevelt, continued during the post-war era, had demonstrated that a more managed form of capitalism is more efficient as well as more equitable. But the ultras, the people who believe that, you know what, textbook economics, ultra-free market economics, that was right after all, they get another turn. And so we get Milton Friedman, we get Ronald Reagan, we get Margaret Thatcher, and we get the use of the trading system rather than just having reciprocal reductions in tariffs or reciprocal reductions in quotas. The trading system is used to dismantle the ability of individual nations to have a more regulated form of capitalism. Things that are simply ordinary forms of regulation that had been normal in the 40s and 50s and 60s start being defined as an improper interference with somebody's property rights. The trading system's new rules are used to make it harder to regulate banks. If you come up with some kind of toxic security that nobody understands except the entity that's making a fortune by issuing the security, like credit default swaps, and you try to regulate it, the bank will say, well, if you don't allow us to do this in New York, we'll just do it in London, or maybe we'll do it in Zurich, or maybe we'll do it in Frankfurt. And the more the economy gets globalized, the harder it becomes to maintain this system of managed capitalism that had worked so well for so many people in the 30 years after the World War II. You have a version of ground rules for labor that allows companies to outsource jobs to countries that have no labor standards whatsoever. And there's an international institution called the International Labor Organization that has all kinds of labor standards, but none of them are mandatory. So if you outsource work to a country that uses child labor, that uses prison labor, that pays people sub-poverty wages, that's perfectly okay. And so the new rules of globalization make it harder and harder for countries to have the kind of social contract, if you will, that broadly served the whole population and that strengthened democracy. And what happens is that over a period of 20 or 30 years, regular working people conclude that if elites care about their counterparts in other countries more than they care about me, the hell with them. I'll look for somebody who at least pretends to care about me. And his name may be Donald Trump. It may be Viktor Orban. It may be any number of people in Europe who invoke ultranationalism as the cure for globalism. And so Karl Marx really got it wrong. Karl Marx thought that if the workers were sufficiently oppressed, the workers of the world would unite. That's not what happens. What happens is that the workers of Poland or Hungary or the United Kingdom or the United States, they look to homegrown ultranationalists who are not going to provide any real solutions to their economic grievances, but who are going to provide scapegoats. And then you add to that mix a flow of immigrants, a flow of refugees. I mean, Europe has had 10% unemployment since the collapse of 2008. We've been luckier. We've had a recovery, even though real wages for most people have not gone up very much, but at least we'd have a recovery. In Europe, because they have pursued austerity policies, local working people are pretty unhappy. They see their living standards going down the drain. They see elites, whether of the center left or the center right, not caring very much about them. And then on top of it, Angela Merkel, German chancellor, most powerful leader of any Western European country, decides that Germany has a moral debt to pay because of what Germany did in World War II, and Germany is going to bend over backwards to be very liberal towards refugees, and Germany is going to admit 1 million refugees. Well, in order to do that, if you're a democracy, you need the consent of the voters. And the voters were not really all that enthusiastic about this. And so the official opposition party in Germany now is the Alternative for Deutschland, a neo-Nazi party. Because when things are not going all that well economically, and they're going better in Germany, by the way, than they are in any other country in Europe, people are not terribly charitable towards others. They're not terribly charitable towards refugees and immigrants. And I think in the United States, the counterpart is that at the very moment when political elites of both parties are not paying much attention to what happens to ordinary working people, at that very moment, social liberals are telling working class white people, you need to open your hearts to black people. You need to open your hearts to immigrants. You need to open your hearts to transgender people who want to have the right to use whatever bathroom they want to. And the problem is that somebody in Western Pennsylvania or Ohio or Wisconsin whose livelihood has just gone down the drain says, oh, no, I don't. Because the same globalists who really are contemptuous of me, they're the same people who are going to take away my guns. They're the same people who think they have more in common with their counterparts at Davos than they have with me. They're the same people who think it's okay to murder an unborn child. They're the same people who don't respect my church. And I'm just going to find somebody else to vote for. And Donald Trump, who is probably the embodiment of cognitive dissonance, right? It takes a lot of cognitive dissonance on the part of voters for somebody who's a corrupt billionaire to be the emblem of working class discontent, but go figure. He at least knew how to channel it. He knew how to do the dog whistle. He knew how to articulate it. And Hillary Clinton, God bless her, is so tone deaf that she's taking six-figure honoraria from Goldman Sachs in the same year that she's running for president. And I'll leave aside all the other mistakes that she made. But the point is, if you want to champion the rights of transgender people to use their own bathroom, you damn well better give a damn about the working class, or you're not going to be voted into office to do either thing. And so let me address my own question. Can democracy survive global capitalism? Well, maybe. The problem right now is that we have had too much old-fashioned, raw, laissez-faire, pre-1929 capitalism and not enough democracy, because it really takes strong democracy to leash capitalism, to harness capitalism in the public interest. Why? Because people of great wealth use their wealth to buy whatever they want. And it's only natural to think that that wealth can also buy political influence. And at that point, wealth money starts crowding out democracy. The Koch brothers start making public policy. And if you have that going on in one ring of the circus, and ordinary people in the other ring of the circus thinking that elites don't give a damn about folks like me, and if this is what democracy delivers, then the heck with democracy. And I think that's what regular people are concluding, tragically, all over the world. The solution, the remedy, is stronger democracy and more of an effort to harness the market economy in the broad public interest so that the benefits are better diffused, as was the case in the 30 years after World War II. It's going to be harder now because we had kind of a tailwind after World War II. We had a prestigious state that had a lot of legitimacy. We had government doing things for people that were recognized and valued, things like the GI Bill and all of the public investments that occurred in that era. We had a much stronger trade union movement. We had rising real wages for regular people. And so the government had more legitimacy and prestige. Democracy had more legitimacy and prestige. We were expanding democracy. I think now economic elites have so much more power that a lot of folks have given up on democracy. I think the one thing we have going for us is that Donald Trump is a particularly incompetent demagogue. I worry what might have happened if he were a more competent demagogue. But he's mentally unhinged. He has a very short attention span. And he's about to get in a peck of trouble given the fact that Mueller has handed over a lot of what he has to the U.S. Attorney in New York, so that even if he fires Mueller, this stuff is not going to evaporate. And I think before too long, the Republican Party is going to be put in a huge bind. Do they stand by their man no matter what? Or at some point, if the evidence becomes so compelling, do they decide to trade him in for Pence? But I think either way, it's going to be a good year for the Democrats. I think the blue wave phenomenon will play out in November. I think it's very likely that Democrats will take back the House. I think the Republican Party will be divided by whatever happens to Trump between the elite Wall Street Republicans, Koch brother Republicans, and the Tea Party Republicans. And the fact that you've had something like 40 Republican Congress people decide not to stand for re-election, that tells you that they know something. So the stage is set for a political reversal, although never put it past the Democrats to blow a winnable election. I don't have a crystal ball. I would not pretend to tell you what I think is going to happen, but at least it's possible. It's possible that the wheel could turn again. And my pal Steve Bannon talked about the deep state, the administrative state, the ballast of the constitutional system that made it impossible for Trump to snap his fingers and do whatever he wanted. And mercifully, the deep state is holding. It suffered a lot of damage, but if you look at the judicial system is holding. If you look at separation of powers is holding. And yes, there will be an election in November of 2018. And yes, because of gerrymandering, the Republicans will probably steal 20 seats that they would not be entitled to if you did it on the basis of straight population. But the Democrats will probably pick up enough seats to take back Congress. So there is a resilience to American democracy. I think it will withstand even Donald Trump. And then I think the question is whether the next president, if a Democratic nominee is in fact elected, will be a president in the Roosevelt mold, which is what it will take to restore the faith of ordinary working people who have been really taking it on the chin for two or three decades in American democracy, in American capitalism. And I think this is particularly true of the young. The millennial generation is really the stunted generation, and I keep waiting for that to be politicized. I think it's starting to be politicized in the fact that so much of the so-called blue wave is being spearheaded by the young. But if you look at this from a generational point of view and you compare my generation and many of your generations with what somebody who's 30 years old who doesn't have well-to-do parents faces, it's startling to me that there isn't a revolution going on. And I think the candidate who champions the frustrations and the aspirations of millennials could be the next president. For instance, $1.2 trillion of college loans, college debt. My generation, no college debt. Kids who didn't have rich parents like me could still go to college with no debt. Unaffordable housing, unreliable jobs, no pension system other than Social Security. Look at what these kids face. And I think a political candidate who said, let's have substantial debt forgiveness, let's go back to free public higher education, let's have some kind of housing policy that makes it affordable for young people to purchase their first home, let's restart some kind of universal portable pension plan because you can't live just on Social Security. Let's not be satisfied with this system where there are no reliable jobs. You know, there's a whole fable being told to the young that goes something like this. You know, you don't really need a house because you're going to have to move anyway. And it's sort of cooler to have your own apartment. And you spend most of your time in Starbucks with your laptop, so you don't need a big house. And you don't need a car. It's healthier. It's better exercise. It's better for the environment for you to use your bike. And it's actually a good thing that you're going to have 20 different jobs in the course of your life. And at some point, the 30-year-olds, this maybe looks cool when you're 28, but when you're 35 and you want to have kids, it doesn't look so cool. They're going to wake up and they realize that this is not just a superior alternative lifestyle. It's a deprivation of standards of living. And public policy could change that. So there's an Italian radical by the name of Antonio Gramsci who was put in jail in the 20s by Benito Mussolini. And Gramsci used to say, pessimism of the mind, optimism of the will. Now, the will has this sort of Hitlerian 30s kind of feeling about it. I don't like that. So I translate it liberally as pessimism of the mind, optimism of the heart. You have to be something of a pessimist based on what you've seen and what you know and what your intellect tells you. But you have to be an optimist based on what your hopes are. And I think there's just enough evidence to persuade us to be hopeful. So that's the note I'd like to end on, and I'd be happy to take your questions, and thanks so much for listening.
I think it's becoming apparent that the coming robotics revolution could put a lot of people out of work. I mean, once 350,000 trucks without drivers run around the roads in the United States, there will be 350,000 people out of work. And you know, they're already having they're already building hamburger flippers and pizza makers and all of that. Yeah. So it's going to be a huge problem.
So this is a question that I get. Let me repeat it. What about robotics? What about artificial intelligence? Where are the jobs going to come from? Let me respond to this in a couple of ways. In 1938, 1939, after 5 or 6 years of Roosevelt, the unemployment rate was still 15%. And a lot of economists of that era blamed it on technological unemployment. A lot of economists of that era said, well, we're just going to have to get used to this. There just are not enough jobs to go around. And then the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And in the first 6 months of 1942, the War Department entered $100 billion worth of orders for war materiel, and unemployment melted down to about 1.5%. So I think there's plenty of work to do. There was a Nobel laureate in economics named Vasily Leontief, and this is 1974, a long time ago. It's before robotics. It's before artificial intelligence. And Leontief had a parable. He said, you know, at some point, the economy is going to become so productive that there will be one human worker, and her job will be to flip the switch, and everything else will be made by machines. And then, said Leontief, there are two questions. One, who gets the benefit of all of that productive wealth? And two, what does everybody else do for a living? So if the economy keeps becoming more productive every year at the rate of 2 or 3% a year, and the economy is twice as productive and twice as rich on average as it was a generation ago, there's plenty of wealth to go around, and there ought to be plenty of work to go around. Even if it's not industrial work, what if we said everybody who works in the human service sector shall get at least $25,000 or $30,000 a year? What if those wonderfully dedicated CNAs who took care of my mother before she died, who were all immigrants, instead of getting $7 an hour, what if they got $30,000 a year? Public policy could do that. What if we had a World War II scale public infrastructure program to modernize infrastructure in this country and to have a green transition? That would produce plenty of jobs. So there's an author by the name of Tom Frank who wrote a book called What's the Matter with Kansas? And then he wrote a sequel last year called Listen Liberal. And Frank has a wonderful line. He said, technology is not what's driving inequality. Technology is the excuse for not doing anything about it. And I think he's right.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but part of your beginning premise is that right after World War II, there was this nice balance of like social programs and market forces, right? How do you deal with the idea that those social programs disproportionately benefited white Americans and didn't benefit like black Americans very much at all?
Well, it's a good question. Did everybody hear the question? It wasn't just social programs, by the way. It was a full employment economy. It was strong trade unions. But one of the great sins of the New Deal, my friend Richard Rothstein has written a wonderful book about this called The Color of Law that I highly recommend. In order to enact the New Deal, Roosevelt had to make a deal with the Southern racists who controlled the committee chairmanships in Congress, and it was mostly a New Deal for white people. On the other hand, there are a lot of black people named Roosevelt, and Eleanor, and to some extent Franklin, bent over backwards to make sure that at least some of the benefits went to black people as well. And there's a really interesting statistic that even though we did not get around to legislating civil rights until the 1960s, the racial income distribution becomes more equal in the 40s and 50s and early 60s. Well, how could that be? And the answer is class, that the class income distribution becomes more equal, and most black people are working class. So if you're lifting up the working class, you're lifting up a disproportionate number of black people. Now, I take your point. It's much, much harder to have redistributive programs, to have programs of uplift when you have a society that has all kinds of schisms of race. And I think the only possible remedy for that is to try to take the focus off race and put it on class. When Martin Luther King was murdered just 50 years ago this month, he was in Memphis striking with sanitation workers, and he was shifting the focus from racial issues to economic issues. And I think the only prayer we have is emphasizing what unites black people who are not rich with white people who are not rich, and emphasizing commonalities. A very good example is Medicare. Nobody thinks of Medicare as a program of racial uplift. But the fact is that a disproportionate share of African Americans have really terrible health insurance when they're 64, and they suddenly get good health insurance when they turn 65 because they qualify for Medicare. And so it is possible to have programs of general uplift that address the needs of multiple races. But I grant you, in a multiracial society, this is harder. And the social democracies of Northern Europe had a much easier time back when those countries were homogeneous, before they admitted lots of immigrants. The Swedes did the Swedish Social Democrats in the 1930s did a really clever thing. Nationalism in that era was associated with the right wing. And the Swedish Social Democrats redefined the idea of a Swedish homeland as a decent society that people deserve to have as Swedes. If you are a Swede, you deserve a decent job. You deserve a decent home. You deserve a decent school for your kids to go to. And so the Social Democrats, as the left of center party, redefined nationalism in a kind of more communitarian way, and they took it away from the right. That works fine until 10% of Swedes are from Somalia. And if you define your welfare state as something that benefits Swedes, it becomes a little hard to extend that to others who speak a different language, whose skin is a different color, who don't speak Swedish, who are seen as alien. So race is always going to be a challenge in a multiracial society, especially a multiracial society with a legacy of racism.
I'd like to hear you talk about velocity of currency, because I hear this argument being used in two opposite ways. When corporations or football or baseball companies come to us and say, oh, we want to build this project in our community and have you invest because you're going to create jobs and that job income is going to bounce through the economy. This is wonderful. And then when we on the left say, well, we want to hire more teachers, teachers' assistants, using the same public funds, and this money is going to bounce through the economy. Well, you get people like the chair of the St. Louis Fed saying, oh, this is terrible because it's going to be inflationary. So I would just like to hear you talk about velocity of money in these two different scenarios and what's going on with that.
Can you be a little more precise about how the concept of velocity of money...
Oh, yeah. But this is what I learned in Economics 102, that if you give somebody at the lower end of the economic spectrum some money, they are going to go to the store and spend it. The store shopkeeper is going to spend it on supplies.
Yeah, okay.
So it's going to bounce more often through the economy than if you give the money to somebody at the high end by giving billionaires tax cuts.
Right. Okay. Got it. So this is the classic argument of the demand side versus the supply side. And the demand side would say working people spend all of their money. They spend more than all of their income. They go into debt. They probably spend 105% of their income. And so if you give a benefit to a poor person, the concept here is a multiplier. That's going to have more of a multiplier effect on the rest of the economy than if you give a tax cut to a rich person. And I think, broadly speaking, that's true. And then the supply side argument would be, well, but if you give a tax cut to an entrepreneur, he or she will go out and build a factory, create jobs. And that's true up to a point. And the real fight is about where that point is. So we just had a tax cut equal to $1.5 trillion on the premise that this is going to increase investment. Now, what's actually happened is most of that money is going to stock buybacks. It's not going to investment at all. And a stock buyback is a technique whereby the executives in a company, in order to pump up the share price and increase their own bonus, will go out on the open market and buy back shares of the company stock, which then bids up the value of the stock. It doesn't create anything of economic worth. And if you go back to the period of the 50s and 60s, when the top marginal rate in this country on individual income was 91%, and the corporate rate was much higher, this was a period when the economy was booming. So if ordinary people have money in their pockets and can afford to go out and buy things, business will do just fine. This was a period of explosive entrepreneurship. Granted, the United States had a bit of a leg up because the rest of the Western economy was still rebuilding from the war. There wasn't a lot of competition from other countries. But other countries were doing really well, too, and they had the same high tax rates. So I think the idea that you have to reward business with very low taxes and other kinds of concessions in order to persuade entrepreneurs to do what they do, you know, it's a convenient myth, but it's not good economics.
Would you speak to the Obama era and how that fits into your idea of managed capitalism?
Yeah, it's a tough question. Let me take you back to the fall of 2008. Barack Obama miraculously has gotten the nomination for the Democratic Party, first African-American nominee of a major party. And he's an outsider. He's a freshman senator. And he's eloquent. And he's compelling to a lot of voters. And then, fortuitously, the economy collapses. And it collapses on the watch of the Republican incumbency. And so Obama and the Republican nominee, John McCain, and their advisors have urgent conferences on what do we do about this. And Obama turns out to be much more persuasive than McCain, who really is not persuasive at all. So Obama gets elected, and he has an approval rating of 71% his first couple of months in office. Now, I wrote a book. I'll tell you the story. I got really interested in studying transformative presidencies. What does it take for a leader to be not just a transactional leader, but a really transformative leader? The guy who came up with this concept was the political historian James McGregor Burns. And so I called Doris Kearns Goodwin, who's a friend, and I said, you know, you really ought to write a book about transformative presidencies and the potential of Barack Obama to be a transformative president. And she said, no, I can't do that. I'm finishing my book on Teddy Roosevelt, but you ought to write this book. I'll read the manuscript, and I'll help you. I said, wow. So I said, okay. So I got a contract to write the book, and then I took two enormous risks. First, I assumed that there would be a financial collapse, and then I assumed that Barack Obama would be elected. And so I wrote the book, and the book was published in September of 2008, and the crash happened on schedule. Obama got elected. Good for me. Well, here's the problem. In June of 2008, when Obama realized that he's going to be the nominee, he was persuaded that, okay, it's time to bring in the heavy hitters. It's time to bring in the team of serious, credible economic advisors. And who does he turn to? He turns to the people who had advised Bill Clinton to deregulate the economy, which sowed the seeds of the economic collapse of 2008. And when I saw Obama appointing Larry Summers, Tim Geithner, other proteges of Robert Rubin, I said to myself, this is over before it starts. This is like Roosevelt reappointing Herbert Hoover's economic team. And so instead of being a transformative president economically, Obama was a pretty good president economically, but I wrote a whole book on this. He prematurely embraces austerity economics. He prematurely embraces budget balance. And he hired people from the Wall Street wing of the Democratic Party. So the Rooseveltian moment was lost, and I think race really complicated it. Obama temperamentally was a person of great dignity, of great probity, of great intellect, an absolutely admirable person. As a president, he was rather cautious. I think some of that was temperamental, characterological. I think some of it was because he was very risk-averse on race. If you read Dreams from My Father, which Obama wrote when he was 33 years old, before anybody had ever heard of him, there was no ghostwriter. This was Obama writing from the heart. And he's 33. He's still paying off his student loans. He writes this incredibly eloquent book where he talks a lot about race. And he talks about race when he gives the keynote address to the 2004 Democratic Convention, which puts him on the map as a real contender. But then when he becomes president, I think for some legitimate reasons, he's concerned that he doesn't want to become a lightning rod for racists. And he doesn't talk about race. And the one time he did talk about race was it during the campaign when the Jeremiah Wright affair blew up on him and he almost was just destroyed, and he had to give that speech, and he had to give the best speech of his life. And it was one of the best speeches anybody has ever given on race, on why people of Jeremiah Wright's generation were so angry and why it was right for them to be angry and why he doesn't embrace Jeremiah Wright's demonization of white people, but he understands it and he admires Jeremiah Wright. And he threads his way through this impossible situation, and then he just stops talking about race. So I think Obama was a thoroughly admirable human being. I think he was a pretty good leader. I think there was a moment when he could have been a transformative leader, and he did not rise to that occasion.
Thank you very much for your message. You know, in Germany, it seems to me that almost two-thirds of the votes are on the left. They're left of center. I worry about our ability to accept managed capitalism. And I wonder if you could compare Canada and us. If I'm right, Canada did not have the financial explosion. Could you help me believe in a communitarian United States? I think we're so individualized. If we just cared for one another a little more, it would help.
Well, you mentioned two different countries, plus the United States, Canada and Germany, and that's a great question. Let me take them in succession. So, yeah, Canada has a much more managed brand of capitalism than we do. Industry in the United States has just declared open war on trade unions. And so in the private sector, the percentage of trade unionism in this country which peaked at maybe 35%, it's down below 7%. In Canada, it's still 40%. And, yeah, there are lots of things wrong with unions. But compared to what? Compared to corporations? Compared to corporations? And the fact that working people had organized institutions to stick up for their interests was a big part of why we had a more egalitarian form of capitalism in the 30 years after the war. Now, Canada has universal health insurance, and people love it. You know, a poll was done about 10 years ago on the most admired Canadian. And who do you think won that poll? Wayne Gretzky? Pierre Trudeau? No, the most admired Canadian in that poll was a guy named T.C. Douglas, Tommy Douglas, who was the Prime Minister of Saskatchewan, who brought the first universal health insurance to a province of Canada. Can you imagine that? I mean, I know Canadians are viewed as kind of wonky, but that tells you either that Canadians are just strange people or they're people who really, really value their national health insurance. And this is a country not all that different from our own. I mean, it's, you know, a settler country that was once a settlement, a colony of Great Britain. But for a variety of reasons, managed capitalism has taken root in Canada. Also, Canada, I think, as you alluded to, did not have a financial crisis because they did not go nuts and deregulate their whole banking system. Reminds me of another story. When I was on the book circuit giving talks about my book, Obama's Challenge, in 2008, 2009, after the collapse, I happened to be at a conference at the UN, and I was on a panel with a guy named Yaga Reddy, who was the Governor General of the National Bank of India. And I don't know anything about India, and so I was making small talk with him, and I said, how's India doing? How's the world recession affecting India? He said, oh, we're doing fine. We had, 6% growth last year. We're expecting 8% growth next year. I said, well, how did you dodge the bullet? How were you not done in by the shock effects of the financial collapse? He said, we're a poor country. We're a developing country. And we don't understand these complex financial instruments like credit derivatives. And so we leave them to the advanced countries like you. And Reddy, in his role as regulator, had just made it illegal for Indian banks or Western banks doing business in India to use any of these toxic financial instruments. So this was an optional crisis. It was a crisis that didn't have to happen. Now, you said another interesting thing. Is there, in fact, a leftish or a center-left majority that somehow doesn't find an expression in politics? I wish that were true. There was a moment when that was true. For instance, there's a chapter in my book called The Disgrace of the Center-Left, which talks about how Clinton in the United States and Blair in Britain and Gerhard Schroeder in what was then West Germany, it was already Germany, unified Germany, essentially embraced the program of the center-right, either because they thought it was popular or because they thought it was creating a political alliance for them with business. When Margaret Thatcher left office and became Baroness Thatcher, she was being interviewed, and the interviewer asked her what she thought her greatest achievement was. And she thought for a moment, and she said, I think my greatest achievement was Tony Blair. Meaning that Blair had embraced most of the Tory program. And the same thing happened in Germany. And there was a moment, Schroeder deregulated a lot of the financial system so that it could become more speculative. He enacted rules, the so-called Hartz reforms, that deregulated a lot of labor. And this angered so many of his compatriots in the Social Democratic Party that they split off and formed a separate Linkspartei, a left party. Now, in the election of, I guess it was 2005, maybe, there was a left majority. The left party, the Social Democratic Party, and the Green Party had a majority of seats in the German parliament, but they were so at each other's throats that Schroeder preferred to have the Social Democrats be the junior coalition partner with Merkel's party. So there was a time when there was more of a sentiment in favor of left-wing parties, but I think what's happened is that left-wing parties completely blew their credibility as any kind of opposition to the globalist consensus that's doing such damage to ordinary working people. And I think they're going to have to get that back. Otherwise, we are just ceding the field to Trump and people like Trump in the rest of the West. Yeah.
I think the mantra in the Clinton era was, it's the economy, stupid. Well, it seems to me that most of the people in this country, they're not stupid, they're just uninformed. And they're uninformed because we have a lousy educational system. So could you address what we can do to have people more informed so that just don't make an elective decision based on whether you could have a baby or not, or whether God is the Bible is the Word of God?
You're really asking a two-part question. I mean, you're asking a question about the nature of the quality of the educational system generally, And you're also asking about people who are so disaffected that they say, I don't care about the facts. This guy's articulating my frustrations, so I'm going to vote for him. And I think it's not that people who voted for Trump were the dumbest kids in the class. Some of them were actually pretty well educated. It's that they're just very angry that the world they knew has been taken from them. Now, some of that's racism. Some of that's sexism. They don't like the fact that blacks have a seat at the table. They don't like the fact that women are playing more of an economic role than they were a generation ago when the little wife was at home with a hot meal and you went off to the factory and brought home a good job and she knew her place and you had your place. So I don't think it's simply ignorance. I think it's anger and frustration. At the same time, there are huge problems with the education system. Independent of the Trump backlash, and we were talking about this at dinner, the problem is not so much schools in inner cities. The problem is that we are expecting schools to make up for all of the rest of the pathologies that go along with poverty. And a study was done that compared how kids do on international standard educational tests. If you limit the sample to school districts that have less than 10% of the kids eligible for subsidized school lunches, in other words, if you limit it to affluent suburban schools, and guess what? The kids, the American kids in the affluent suburban schools compare very favorably to the other kids in the countries that score at the very top. So I think it's completely unrealistic to expect schools to make up for all of the pathologies of poverty. That's not to say we shouldn't be investing more in schools. We should. They're one institution that we can use to make a difference. It would be easy to blame the Trump phenomenon on ignorance. But I think tragically there's a lot more going on, and the challenge is to address all the other things that are going on. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.